This is KVRF, and I'm Kenny Pasenik. My guest today is local author and former mayor of Anchorage, Rick Maestrom. He's an accomplished entrepreneur, politician, and philanthropist. 50 years ago, he was diagnosed as a type 1 insulin-dependent diabetic. He's joined me in the studio today to discuss his two books chronicling his life with diabetes, My Wonderful Life with Diabetes, an inspiring and empowering story of living healthy, living active, and living well with diabetes as part autobiography and part Diabetes 101. He illustrates the highs and lows of living with diabetes, especially the scary lows of low blood sugar episodes, but most importantly, the highs of living a happy, healthy, and adventuresome life with diabetes. His companion book, What Should I Eat? Solve Diabetes, Lose Weight, and Live Healthy, is based on his 50 years of patient research of how best to thrive with diabetes. Since the invention of self-test strips, Rick has given himself about 60,000 blood sugar tests. This book is a direct result of living and learning day-to-day with diabetes. Thank you, and welcome to the studio.
Well, Kenny, thank you very much. That's about as good an introduction to the two books as I've heard. So great job. Thank you for doing all that research.
Oh, no problem. The books were fantastic. They were both very enjoyable reads.
Good.
First, I'd like to say that after reading both of your books, much of my fear of diabetes has been diminished. I have a grandfather and a few friends with diabetes, and you present diabetes as not a scary life sentence, but an opportunity to live a better and healthier life. Did you fear diabetes when you were first diagnosed?
Did I fear it? Yeah. It was, and I'm a type 1, and there's two types of diabetes, type 1 and type 2, and I'll explain that later on during the interview. But yeah, I was afraid. I remember when I got the diagnosis, my roommate came running out to the tennis court and said, the doctor wants to see you. I had just had a physical a couple of days before, or a day before. The doctor wants to see you right away. It's a Friday afternoon. And he said, the doctor said he'll keep his office open until you get there. So I changed clothes, put a pair of long pants on. I was playing tennis and hopped in my 55 Chevy and drove down to the doctor's office. And he indicated that I had sugar diabetes and asked me what I knew about it. And I said, nothing. Mm. And then he did this great thing. He said, go to the library, the Norland Library at the University of Colorado, and read everything you can about diabetes. And then come back Monday and we'll give you a confirming test. And while we're giving you that test, I'll answer all those questions. And it was a great way for me to get started with diabetes.
That's fantastic. I really enjoyed the beginning of your book as well, because I went to school in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, you did?
I went to Naropa University, so I was down the hill from CU, but I've spent time in Norland and such. And so I wondered about that because it seems like from both of your books, health, approaching diabetes from a really healthy perspective is really what you're all about. And being a really active person, especially in Colorado, Boulder seems to be it attracts very active people. And I wonder how much of competitive sports, I see throughout the books that you mention a lot of the softball teams and things that you've played on over the years, of how possibly playing in these competitive sports and already having an active lifestyle affected your approach to diabetes.
You know, both those things are very important. And I would say in terms of dealing with type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes, the most important thing is a positive attitude, by far and away. And I promised myself I'd never complain. It took about a month for me to come around to this, but I promised myself I'd never complain about having diabetes. So the most important thing is a positive attitude. The second most important thing is an active lifestyle and good eating habits. And so I tell people when they have a young person, a young son who has diabetes, young daughter who has diabetes, or they had diabetes themselves, you need to get around to the fact that especially type 2 diabetes and type 1 both are an opportunity to learn a lot about food and live healthier than all your peers. And you can do that. The other thing that's really important is understanding food. And that's what the second book is all about, understanding food. And the third thing is really having an active lifestyle. So that was very important. And I think I mentioned, Kenny, in that book that the first 16 years I had diabetes, I couldn't do any blood sugar testing. You know, now I can do it in 5 seconds. And I always carry a tester with me. It's in my car. I always carry a tester with me. So I can test blood sugar like that. But in those days, you couldn't do it. And you had to go to a doctor. A doctor would send you down to a lab. The lab would send take blood out of your arm, send it out to an analytical lab. It would come back to that lab, back up to my doctor, and I'd get a call and say, well, your blood sugar was 250 4 days ago.
Yeah.
So what good does that do?
Yeah.
Now I do it every day. And so, but what I know, what my point is that from those days, I know now that my blood sugar was probably high most of the time because I've learned so much in the last 35 years testing. But that normally would be a real problem for diabetics and cause all kinds of problems. But I think my active lifestyle saved me from having those problems.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really important point that you make a distinction in your first book with My Wonderful Life, that it's in those years before self-testing that you were really having to play a game of what's best for me at what time. And you've had some close calls with some low blood sugar episodes. Mm-hmm. And I wonder what really helped you the most when it came to saying, okay, what did I learn from this low blood sugar episode? Or how should I be on the higher end of keeping my blood sugar high? Or because you talk about tight control and loose control of diabetes.
Yeah, well, I think you've asked the core question for diabetics. Do you really try to keep it on the low side, try to keep it on the high side? And I really learned, you know, before I really have never had any low blood sugar estimate or episodes when I was competing in sports. And the reason was is before blood sugar testing, I would always have a candy bar before I went out to compete. Mm-hmm. That's something I don't have to do now because I can test my blood sugar. But that was probably not a bad idea when you didn't know, because my whole goal was to avoid the seizures that I would have with low blood sugar episodes. And they're really scary events. Your blood sugar gets down, gets lower and lower, and normal is about 75 to 105. And it gets down to 40. Well, it gets down to 50, and I'm starting to feel it. If it gets down to 40, I know it's low, but I can't always figure out a solution. You know, at 40, I can go to the refrigerator, open the door, and see a Coke or an orange juice or something in there that'll raise my blood sugar. And I'll just stand there in front of the refrigerator door for a minute trying to say, what am I doing looking in the refrigerator? What am I looking for? And so right around 40, you need other people's help. And oftentimes I tell my wife, I say, I need some sugar. I need something right now. And she'd get a Coke and mix it with a little bit of chocolate. And because that flattens the Coke out, makes it easier to drink fast. So the low blood sugars are a scary episode. And for type 1 diabetics, they're going to have some in their lifetime. And my purpose in these books was to try to let them know and their parents know that it's a scary episode, but it's not necessarily life-threatening. You know, it's a very rare occasion that anybody dies from that.
I wanted to ask you about the role of family. And I don't know if your wife, Mary, if she would have advice on being a spouse of a diabetic as well, because it seems like when you get to that point of not knowing what it is that you need and having to be dependent on those around you or how to ask for help is usually really hard.
The spouses or other family members are really important, and they need to know the symptoms of low blood sugar, what's happening. Most of the time, I can solve it myself. If it gets low, I solve it before it gets too low. But they need to know exactly what's going to happen. But I think the wonderful thing about Mary is that she not only knew about diabetes, but she never, ever in my life said, well, you shouldn't eat that. You better not eat that. And I talk to a lot of diabetics who say, oh, my wife's always saying, or my husband's always saying, don't eat that or don't eat this. And there's conflict there. And, you know, and Mary's never done that. And it comes from her belief, I think, that I can make this work. At least at the start, now she knows I have been making it work. So I think that's really important for spouses.
Yeah, to have that support.
And
Did you have any diabetic role models when with trying to navigate, it seems that, or were you without a map and without a compass?
I didn't. I didn't know anybody who had diabetes except one kid in my high school that I'd moved away from 5 years ago, or 5 years before. And I was a little embarrassed to tell people I had diabetes. I didn't talk about it at all. I was because, you know, you're a young 20-year-old athletic guy that's invulnerable. With all that testosterone going through your body, you don't want to say I'm weak. You know, I don't have this. I don't know. So I didn't tell many people about it. I just kept it to myself for a year or so. But then gradually I got around to being willing to talk about it because I knew how important it was for friends and family to know what to do.
I was wondering with your companion book with What Should I Eat? It has fantastic graphs in it and illustrating blood sugar rises after eating specific foods. And when you started putting this together, were you thinking about specifically what foods that you're eating or what you expect that maybe your audience, what type of foods that they would be eating? Because I know there's in our national obsession with weight loss that this seems to be a common thing of diet. And you make a distinction between lifestyle changes and diet. And I wonder, how were you writing this? Were you writing this as your personal experience or trying to write for other diabetics?
I started writing it as part of the whole first book. It was the first book had alternating chapters of my memoir with diabetes as well as what to do. And that was really kind of difficult. And I changed the structure a little bit. But when I finished that book, there was 640 pages. And my publishing consultant said, Rick, you know, nobody's going to read that. They can't even carry it. Yeah. Why would they read it?
Yeah.
And he said, you've got to break it into two books. And so then I spent about a year rewriting this into two different books. But when I started this, What to Eat, I realized, and I've always known that there are so many more type 2 diabetics in America than type 1. There's about 3 million type 1 diabetics in America, about 30 million type 2 diabetics in America, and another 30 million people out there who are going to have diabetes or who already have it and don't know it. And so it's an epidemic in terms of numbers that's bigger than the bubonic plague or the black plague. Now, it's not as sudden and you don't die within a week, so it's not that kind of urgency. But it's a huge problem with America. It's estimated to cost us $750 billion a year to deal with type 2 diabetes and overweight. And so while I was writing this second book, I realized that this book, what I set out to figure out was the ways to control my blood sugar. But what I discovered was how to live healthy. And I realized that, and the biggest part of that is what you eat. What you put into your body is about 80% of it. Your activity and your structured exercise is about 20%. So I decided to really focus on what people should eat. And one day, about 2.5 years ago, I came up with the idea that only a type 1 diabetic can actually measure what happens inside their body once they eat something. Because when I eat something, if I don't give myself a shot, then that food makes my blood sugar rise. And that rise would tell anybody how much weight gain they're going to have from that and what it does to their blood sugar. And that's where I came on the idea of the graphs. And that is such, that has been received so well by people. Whenever I talk about this book, I make a presentation, I sell between 60 and 80% of the audience size buys a book. So if I make a presentation to 100 people, I'm going to sell 60 to 80 books because it's so important for America. And it's never, ever been done before that a type 1 diabetic, who's the only person who can do this, has eaten food. And what I did with these foods is every morning I eat a different kind of food. And I eat vegetables, whatever it is. I'm not just breakfast, but whatever it was, because my blood sugar is stable in the morning. And then I wouldn't give myself a shot for 90 minutes. And every 10 minutes for 90 minutes, I'd measure my blood sugar and let it go up. And then I'd chart that, and then I got the information to a graphic artist, and he graphed it all. And so what it shows everybody is what foods will make them fat and what foods will make them thin and what foods will make their blood sugar high and what foods will not make their blood sugar high. And that is what makes this book what it is. And there's a lot of explanation of it, but that's the very first thing you mentioned, Kenny, is the graphs. And that's what people love about this book, because they can see for the first time ever exactly what every food does to their blood sugar and therefore weight gain. So now it's not going to make a non-diabetic's blood sugar go up like mine does, but because they have their pancreas produces some insulin and it gets used while it's going up, but it shows how much it would go up and what it contributes to weight without that.
And I think that's a really important point. And you talk about it in both books with what you're eating before bed. And I think that's something that we see in the media a lot of don't eat this before bed or eat this before bed and what this does to your blood sugar or the productivity of your liver or whatever it is. And I thought that was really interesting with really being conscientious of first thing in the morning, obviously, as well, but right before bed, because you talked a lot about low blood sugar episodes at night. And I found that really interesting with how food interacts.
It's important. You know, before I talk about that, and we'll get back to what to eat before bed because that's really important, is I think it's important to make a distinction between type 1 and type 2 diabetes because a lot of people out there listening don't know that. So let me explain very simple terms in layman's terms the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Now, when I eat something, you're a non-diabetic. When you eat something in the morning, some food in the morning, that's everything that you eat, whether it's eggs or bacon or cereal or pasta or, well, I'm not going to eat pasta in the morning, but whatever you eat in the morning is going to create a certain
amount. I have been a college student sometimes.
Oh, you have? Okay, so you probably eat some pasta in the morning.
Pizza in the morning. Yeah.
Okay. But whatever you eat, every bit of that food turns into some amount of glucose. Mm. Some foods turn into a lot of glucose, others to little glucose. So when that glucose gets into your bloodstream, your body sends a message to the pancreas that says you need to produce some insulin because there's glucose in the bloodstream. And insulin is a hormone that allows the body to use that glucose in the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So the insulin produces the pancreas produces insulin, and the food that you eat gets used. And if you eat too much, the rest of it gets stored. Mm-hmm. And the first thing, it goes to cells for energy. Second, it goes to the liver to be stored as glycogen, which is a short-term use. And third, it goes to your fat cells around your stomach and your waist and your butt and all the places that we all don't want it.
Yeah.
So a key is how do you keep things from getting stored like that? And what foods can you eat that don't get stored? Now, I'll tell you what happens to me in the same situation. If I eat exactly the same foods as you do, it turns into exactly the same amount of glucose in my body as it did to you. Mm-hmm. My pancreas gets a message that says there's blood sugar, there's glucose in the bloodstream, you need to produce some insulin. My pancreas says, sorry, I quit doing that 50 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I have to give myself shots to try to match that so the food can be used and stored. And that's what I do every day, six, eight times a day sometimes, give myself these little shots with my pump. Now, a type 2 diabetic is a little bit different. And this is the 30 million people out there and the lots of people listening now who are type 2 diabetics. Mm. When a type 2 diabetic eats food, it turns into the same amount of glucose that it did for you and for me in this illustration. The pancreas then gets a message that says there's glucose in the bloodstream. You need to produce insulin so this person can use it. The pancreas says, well, I'll try. You know, you've been asking too much of me for too long, and I'm kind of worn out, and I don't think I can produce enough insulin to use it all. Mm-hmm. So the pancreas produces some insulin, and it gets to the cells for energy, gets to the liver for short-term storage, and gets to the fat cells for long-term storage around your body. But it can't bring your blood sugar all the way down. It can't handle all the glucose in your blood sugar. And so your blood sugar as a type 2 diabetic will remain high. And that's what doctors try to solve with pills and medication. Because if it does remain high too long, that's what causes all the complications. Kidney disease, eye disease, circulation problems, all of those things, foot problems that are bad. But the best way to illustrate in about 15 seconds the difference between a type 1 and type 2 diabetic is if two diabetics were stranded on a desert island. And neither one of them had any insulin. There's a type 1 diabetic and a type 2 diabetic, and neither one of them had any insulin. But on this island, there was catchable fish, there was edible plants, and there was drinking water and a way to make fire. So if they had that, they could eat those plants, they could eat that fish, but within 2 months, the type 1 diabetic would be dead because the type 1 diabetic has to have insulin to survive. Mm-hmm. Within 2 months, the type 2 diabetic would be cured. And that's the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. And by far and away, the best way to cure type 2 diabetes is to change what you're eating and follow the instructions in this book or look at the graphs in this book to see exactly what food you can eat that's going to keep your blood sugar low, not raise it, and also make you lose weight at the same time. That was a long explanation.
I forgot to ask that because from reading both of your books that you make that very clear. And it was a really great distinction because I know people that are both type 1 and type 2. And it was, for me, it was a lot easier to to imagine it that way, mm-hmm. of what insulin dependency is, and then with type 2 that you can make very big changes.
And there are, you know, they use the term insulin dependent type 2. Mm. Some of the type 2 diabetics
have gotten to the point where
I've gotten to the point where they need insulin.
Yeah.
And I wish they would have not used that term. Mm. I wish they would have used insulin assisted, mm-hmm. because you're not dependent. If you're a type 2 diabetic, you're not dependent on it. You may be for a short period of time, mm-hmm. but if you can, you know, learn what foods to eat, you're going to get rid of all those symptoms, period. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be not, you know, you can either say, well, I'll be a non-diabetic, or at least the symptoms of that diabetes are gone. Mm-hmm. And whichever case it is, you're not living like a diabetic.
Mm-hmm. You earlier before, just a few minutes ago, you talked about with lifestyle that and health that about 80% of it's what you eat, 20% of it's your activity, what you're doing. Where would you put positivity? Because you make a really big point in both your books that positive attitude is the biggest piece of all of it.
It is. It is. And I'd put positive attitude as an umbrella over that. Mm-hmm. In terms of what you put into your body, or what are in terms of actually living it, it really is 80% food and 20% activity and exercise. And, mm-hmm. and that comes from empirical formula. I'll explain mm-hmm. how I figured that out. And I do it in the book. I don't know if I want to do it now.
Yeah.
But the overarching issue is positive attitude. If you don't have a positive attitude, you're not going to want to learn about food. You're not going to want to lose weight. You're not going to want to live healthy with type 1 diabetes. And so that's sort of the umbrella over the whole thing that mm-hmm. keeps the storm clouds away. But underneath that umbrella, it's 80% what you put into your body and 20% how you burn it.
Along with the positivity part, I noticed that a lot of what you talked about in your first book is not letting diabetes limit your lifestyle. So there's a picture in the book of you when you're on the assembly as a member of the assembly with the first insulin pump that you talk about, first mm-hmm. insulin pump in Alaska in a converted shoulder holster.
Yeah, it was.
And I wonder how, because you live diabetes in such a public forum, how you were able to not make it or not allow it to limit your choices and your adventuresome lifestyle.
That's a real good question, how I was able to do it. And I think that in my family when I was growing up, my mom and dad were pretty positive. And my older sister, who was a big influence on me, was very, very positive. And I think that was just part of the environment that I grew up in, is that the trick about life is to make it look easy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not hard, and there's good things. And you can see some things, and some people would complain about them, but you can look at them and say, okay, that's no big deal. You know, I'll get past that. Mm-hmm. And so I think it came from my general and there wasn't any revelation on my part, but I think my general upbringing mm. was saying, you know, be positive about life. This is your life. Mm-hmm. Because I could have been pretty negative. My doctor at first when I got it said, well, Rick, by the time you're 40, you could have circulatory problems. This mm. was in 1964, by the way, and technology has improved so much. And mm-hmm. at that point in time, after 20 years with diabetes, you were really going to be very, very frail. Mm-hmm. And he said, you could have circulatory problems, you may have to have amputations, you could have kidney failure, you could have eye problems, and at that time it was blindness. Now they can stop that. Mm. But, you know, to me, as a 20-year-old, 40 was old. I mean, I'd probably be walking with a cane when I'm 40 anyway.
Yeah.
You know, somehow it didn't register that mm-hmm. was just around the corner. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was representative of my whole life up until that point in time to go mm-hmm. from 20 to 40. So I think it was my upbringing that helped me be real positive about it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Along the lines of the technological advances, and describe the difference in what it meant in your daily living from going from insulin shots where you're kind of guessing of mm-hmm. where you are blood sugar-wise to having your insulin pump and being able to self-test, which were almost came in at the exact same time.
It was 1981 changed my life when those things happened in 1981, roughly the self-testing and the insulin pump. Now, I've often thought if somebody announced a cure for diabetes, I would think that's great for America. But for me, you know, it's not going to make much difference in my life. I'd still eat the same way I do right mm-hmm. now, which is really healthy. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have to change my insulin site every 3 days, but now I can give myself a shot. In fact, I didn't give myself a shot for breakfast this morning, so I'll do it right now. I'm just going to give myself 3/10 of a unit or 3.0 units. And so I just plug that into my pump. And now, as we're talking, I'm giving myself a shot. Mm-hmm. So it's really made my life manageable and made having diabetes not a front and center issue. Mm. And I tell the story in the book about my daughter when we were at a family vacation in Hawaii. And we were eating lunch in Lahaina at some little place in Lahaina. Mm-hmm. And she, I don't know how the conversation came up, but she said, Dad, she said, and this is after I'd had diabetes for maybe 35 years. She said, you've never made a big deal out of having diabetes. And that's made so much difference in our family. That's mm-hmm. been so good for our family. And it was really a nice thing to say. But the interesting thing is that I hadn't thought about that and what an impact it might have on the family. Mm-hmm. And nobody had really said it to me for 35 years. It was just sort of there. We played sports and we wrestled and we popped balloons and we went to concerts and we went to games just like any other family. Mm-hmm. No difference.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, they saw me unconscious, and I guess that's a little different.
Yeah. I thought that was great because there's a couple of times where you mentioned all three of your kids would use that as, Dad, how's your blood sugar? Why are you angry at me because of what I did, or is your blood sugar just a little bit low? Maybe you should eat something.
That's one of the symptoms of low blood sugar is irritability. Mm. You know, it's not things are not working. You get irritable. And I told the kids that. And so ever since I told them that, they say, if I got mad at them for something,
like
they say, Dad, is your blood sugar low? You know, and made me think about what happened.
Yeah, exactly. There, also, I wanted to touch on, you mentioned in your first book talking about the Anchorage, you chaired the Anchorage Olympic bid mm-hmm. and doing a lot of international travel. And mm-hmm. I wondered a bit, I think we've only got a couple of minutes left, but wondered a bit with international travel and if you've what you've seen with how diabetes is managed in other countries or just even the practicalities of traveling internationally with time zones and trying to manage
it's
that.
It's really better with an insulin pump mm-hmm. and you can do it because you can leave it. I can leave the insulin pump on my existing time zone or I can change it to new time zones. I had one near seizure at an airport in Amsterdam, but that's the only international problem I can remember having. I don't know about how other countries deal with diabetes because that wasn't part. I was talking about the Olympics.
Yeah.
I wasn't talking about diabetes. But I need to make sure that when I'm up there speaking to the International Olympic Committee and it's being covered worldwide in television, that I didn't have a low blood sugar episode that would have mm-hmm. caused a problem because that would have been the center of that whole presentation and that the one thing people remembered. And so mm-hmm. I'd always go in with my blood sugar a little bit high, maybe 150, 200. Mm-hmm. So I would like to say, if we're down to the last 2 minutes, that David Cheesham at Fireside Books downstairs has mm-hmm. both of these books.
That's where I picked up my copies.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. And David has been a real supporter from the start. He recognized the value. He read the first book, and I'm not sure if he's read the second book. But mm-hmm. So Fireside Books, you can get the books down there.
Yeah.
And you can also get them on Amazon, but Fireside's better. Go to Fireside.
Support our local bookstore.
Yeah.
Last comments, is there anything that you'd like to – just advice for possibly young and old diabetics out there or just – non-diabetics of what lifestyle choices to
yeah,
make.
I would say that one of the best things America can do is to collectively lose weight. Mm. And most of the people I know who are overweight, it's because they don't necessarily know what foods will make them gain weight and what foods don't. And this book, What Should I Eat, can change the way America's going to eat. It's going to take me 3 or 4 years to get this all over America and then to Mexico and then to England and Australia. Mm. But it will change the way America eats if they get this book.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Mr. Maestrom.
You're most welcome.